We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. On April 5th, an explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia killed 29 miners. This was the deadliest accident at a U.S. coal mine since 1970, when 38 were killed in an explosion in Kentucky. Talking about the disaster, President Obama said that it was a failure, first and foremost, of management, but also a failure of oversight and a failure of laws so riddled with loopholes they allow unsafe conditions to continue. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll try to talk about mine safety and talk a little bit about who it is that writes the regulations, who makes sure that they're followed, what kind of sanctions there are against companies that are operating unsafe mines. And the guest for this hour is Celeste Monfortin. She is Assistant Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the School of Public Health and Health Services at the George Washington University, and that is in Washington, D.C. Her particular expertise is in the area of environmental and occupational health, injury prevention, and mine worker health and safety. She worked for more than a decade before she went to grad school in government. She was in the Labor Department. She worked as a legislative analyst at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and then in the Mine Safety and Health Administration, where she was policy advisor and chief of staff to the assistant secretary. And actually, following the last big mine disaster we had at Sago in 2006, also in West Virginia, which killed 12 coal miners, she put her doctoral research on hold for a bit to assist in the investigation that was launched by the governor of West Virginia at that time. As we talk this morning, questions are welcome. We like to bring as many people into the conversation as would like to be involved. You can do that two ways. You can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions and comments to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu, and we will do our best to get everybody into the conversation who would like to be involved. And Professor Monfortin, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate that. There's, I suppose, a number of ways that we could go at this. Maybe it just might be good to just to talk for a moment again just about what happened or what is known about what happened at the Upper Big Branch mine on April 5th. How much is known at this point about there? Clearly, there was an explosion, but what caused it? Is that really known?
No, that's not known at this point. I mean, the individuals who were there on the scene and people in the community and workers who escaped the mine reported a large explosion. And the rescue teams from both the state and the federal government and some of the mining companies, those rescue team individuals who've been in the mine reported back that it was clear there was some type of explosion, but the actual cause is not yet known. Typically, you know, we know from past history that the two main fuel sources for these types of explosions are methane and coal dust, so it's possible it was a combination of both. And we will have to wait for the completion of the investigation to find out what the ignition source was. You know, was it a faulty piece of equipment? Was it, you know, a spark from any number of sources? So that's something that once they can get into the mine to do that forensic work, the public and the families will have a much better idea of exactly what the cause was.
And you think that it is possible to determine the cause?
Absolutely. The teams that will be involved in that forensic work are really skilled at going in, looking at all of the physical evidence, and their training and experience allows them, you know, they can get and they can really find out where the majority of the real damage is, and they can see, you know, the closer you get to a particular area, you're going to see more and more damage. And from that, they will, you know, they may find a piece of equipment. They will find the physical evidence that will lead them to, you know, the best hypothesis of what happened. Mm-hmm. And those individuals are actually called the experts in fires and flames.
And I think that certainly the fact that there were high levels of methane, people were aware that there were high levels of methane. In fact, I think that was one of the things that really hampered the rescue effort after the explosion, that they had some people in there, but they had to pull it back out because there was so much methane.
Right. And what we're understanding now is typically after a fatality or a disaster of this sort, after the bodies are recovered, the teams that are doing the investigation will go back into the site, similar to like a crime scene, and to start collecting that physical evidence. But the methane levels in the Upper Big Branch mine are still too high to safely allow people to go in. And the ventilation experts are really trying to figure out how they can adequately ventilate the mine so that those forensic teams can get into the mine. And it may be, I've heard rumors that it might be 3 or 4 weeks before they can get in.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that methane and coal dust this has got to be a problem in many, many mining situations. That seems probably just to be it. Coal dust is going to be the fact of life of mining and processing coal and trying to get it out of the ground, and I suppose methane as well. What are the usual methods of mitigating dust and methane to try to make sure that you don't get the buildup or you get the conditions for an explosion?
Right. Excellent question. Yeah, when you think about mining work and that extraction process, you are very dramatically changing the natural environment, and you're extracting that ore. And so by the process of extraction, you are both allowing methane to liberate because it's the natural byproduct of the coal, and you're also generating coal dust with the methods that you're using, you know, whether it's a continuous mining machine or a longwall mine, you know, you're creating dust. So the process itself creates these hazards. What we know, however, is that there are very effective ways to control those hazards. So even though you are creating them by the process of mining, you can set up your ventilation systems and your dust control systems so that you are actually either capturing or diluting those hazards. And that's why the ventilation plans and the dust control plans are an integral part of the mining plan. You have to think of these things together. It's not just about how much coal you can take out. It's about how you do that in a way that minimizes the creation of these hazards.
That's, I think, one of the questions that I've certainly have seen a lot of people raising, at least rhetorically, is something like, given the long history of mining and the well-established fact that it's dangerous, and given the fact that our technology has come to a certain level, why is it that we still have mine disasters?
Right. It takes an enormous amount of vigilance. When mining companies are, when the mine is set up and you put your engineering plans together, they need to be built in such a way that they're robust, both in terms of safely extracting the ore, but also controlling the hazards that are inherent in the process. And it really is an engineering exercise, and you build into your plan these ways to extract the ore, but do it in a way that's safely. What we know, however, is that you being the mine operator and the workers there, but the management has primary responsibility for this, is following that mining plan to a T. And if you start varying from the mining plan, if your mining plan calls for X amount of air being ventilated into the mine and you're only putting in half that amount, you're violating your mining plan. You're violating kind of the formula that was developed in order to do this job safely. And one of the things that we know now in looking at the history of violations at the Upper Big Branch mine, there were time after time after time when the inspectors went in and the mining company was not following their own mining plan. They had, you know, the plan called for I'm just going to throw this number out in the air, but it was, 1,500 CFM of air, and they were only pumping in half that amount. And so they were really, pushing the limits outside the scope of what their mining plan called for. In order to do the extraction safely, you have to be meticulous minute by minute following that mining plan. Otherwise, this is, you have disasters like what happened at the Upper Big Branch mine.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this hour. Celeste Monforton is Assistant Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the School of Public Health and Health Services at the George Washington University. That's in Washington, D.C. And in her work, she is particularly interested in things like occupational health, injury prevention, and one major area of her professional interest is mine worker health and safety. And we are talking this morning about that particular problem, that particular issue, and certainly we're making reference to this, the most recent disaster that took place a little earlier in April 5th. This was at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. 29 miners were killed in an explosion. It was the worst accident at a U.S. coal mine since 1970. The deadliest mine accident actually during this time was in a silver mine in Idaho. 91 people died in a fire there. But as far as coal mines are concerned, this was the worst in the last 40 years. And questions are welcome. We have a couple people here ready to go. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll get to somebody here who is on a cell phone on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm in the car. I don't know how good the connection is, so got two quick questions, and I'll go ahead and listen offline. I don't know if this is related, and apologize ahead of time because I don't remember the name, but the last time there was a disaster of this magnitude in the United States, I want to say that there was an owner, and I don't even know if it was coal-related, but he was really quite belligerent, both to the press and to the public about the length and depth of the disaster, and he really seemed to be quite a character. I was wondering if your guest had any run-ins with him or any experiences with him, if he was related to this disaster at all. And then I was wondering if your guest could speak to the mining industry in China and if it relates at all to the United States or what the makeup of that industry is and if there are any like safeguards. And I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for those questions. I believe the gentleman you're referring to is Robert Murray, and that was a disaster that happened in August of 2007 in Utah at the Crandall Canyon mine, and that was a very deep mine, and there was an event called a rock burst where you actually have like an explosion of coal and rock that went into the mine. There were 6 miners that were trapped. A number of others were injured but escaped, and then later there were 3 of the rescue workers who were killed, so a total of 9 miners died in that disaster. And yes, I think most of us remember Mr. Robert Murray, who is the owner of American Coal Company, who was on the news and kind of the public face of the disaster. He is not associated in any way with this mine in West Virginia, but he does run at least one mine in southern Illinois called the Galatia Mine. And I recall that after the Crandall Canyon disaster and the mine had to close, there were a number of miners who were then out of work because of the disaster, and some of them were transported to Illinois so that they could work in one of this company's mines there in Illinois so that they wouldn't be out of work.
Hmm. I don't know if you can say very much about China. It seems sometimes that not only is mining one of the most dangerous occupations on the face of the earth, but if there's any place that you probably don't want to be a miner, it's China. It sounds like it's from the point of occupational health and safety, in the most dangerous occupation. It's maybe one of the most dangerous places to be a miner.
Right. You know, the thing that is going on in China is they have, you know, huge economic development, which is going on in the country, which is a good thing for the population there. But their mining industry looks like our mining industry 100 years ago. And as a public health researcher, the sad fact that you know, I observe is we know now, based on our own sad experiences of killing miners and having explosions, the world knows how to mine coal and other minerals safely. The technology is there. It's really not rocket science. And it's very unfortunate that the lessons that we've learned on, you know, because of the deaths of our own workers does not translate and get incorporated into the production processes being used in China. The thing that was very surprising to me, a few days after the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, I had a young reporter from the Chinese news service call me. Because she recognized, you know, they have a serious problem with mining disasters, and many, many workers die in their own industry, but they were trying to cover this disaster for their readers over in China. And it was quite striking because we are in the U.S., we're not known as a country that would have 29 miners die in coal mine disasters.
I have a couple calls. I promise I'll get right to them. But I find myself thinking again about the quote that I read just right at the very beginning, and that was indeed a direct quote from President Obama, where he said that this was first and foremost a failure of management, but he also said that it was a failure of oversight, and then a failure of laws that have so many loopholes. They allow the mine operators, now these are not his words, these are my words, to kind of dance around the regulations, or at least hold off efforts to force them to make corrections for very long periods of time. So you have mines that manage to pile up all of these citations for safety violations, and you wonder, well, how is it that a mine could have 80 or 100 or 200 or 300 violations and still be operating? So it seems like we have to talk about this on several levels, and we can try to do that. But now, having said all that, is really the problem here one of insufficient regulations? That is, they're not tough enough? Or really, is it about the way that the regulations are enforced?
David, that's something that I've been thinking quite a lot about, and I started thinking about it after Sago. I'm not sure what other industry in this country would have safety inspectors come in, and it would be the norm to have dozens and dozens of violations, and for that to be something that's acceptable. I'm not sure. I haven't quite got my head around why that happens, but I think that some of it might be kind of a cultural system that we've developed where we have a very strong mine safety law, which requires inspections at least four times a year at these mines, and at some mines, inspectors are there nearly every day, and they are finding these hazards, and the operator then is required to fix them. And maybe that model worked in the 1970s when, you know, we were kind of doing this dance about having inspectors and operators and, you know, figuring out what the safety hazards were. But it seems like 40 years later, we should have evolved by now so that you don't have inspectors that are finding hazards that, you know, operators have known for 40 years are problems. And I wonder if there's some type of dependency that's going on where we have mine operators who really are relying on the inspectors to be their private safety guy. And I'm looking at, you know, can we set up a system that our expectations for what is acceptable in the mining industry is not 100 violations per inspection, but it's 3. And for operators that have these large numbers of violations, which are things that are very fundamental, like not following your ventilation plan or having combustible, accumulation of coal dust. Those are things that any person working in a mine, any miner, any foreman can easily identify. And should we be putting more of that responsibility on them to do it? And if they don't, you have a stricter enforcement that says, if you can't do this, you should not be in business.
Well, that it seems, as I read about this, and I don't want to oversimplify, but it does seem to be the problem is the process can be very drawn out. You go to the mine and say, we think you have these problems and we want you to address them, and we're going to give you X amount of time to do that. And the mine owners might just say, yes, we'll take care of that. They might say, well, actually, we don't agree that that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this very long sort of process of you giving them time to address it or giving them time to appeal the citation, that this can go on and on and on for a very long time, and that would allow you to build up all these citations. And it seems that at the end of the day, the ultimate sanction, that is the government shutting down a mine, that seems that's almost, not that it's impossible, but it's almost impossible for the government to do.
It's very rare that they do that. Just to clarify for your listeners, when an inspector finds a hazard, they must cite it, or a violation of a standard, they must cite it, and the operator is required to fix it right away.
Mm-hmm.
So they do fix them. The issue of the contesting really comes into the penalty amount and perhaps the severity of, you know, kind of how it's classified in terms of severity. But in terms of getting rid of the hazard or fixing the problem, that generally is done right away. So it's another kind of twisted way that this dance is done between the inspectors and the mine operators, that these hazards are well known, they're easily fixed, and they continually get the same violation. It's almost like every night when you drive home from work, you get a speeding ticket. You know, and every night you get a speeding ticket, At some point you have to say, you know, I'm going to take your license away because clearly you're not learning your lesson. The same thing, you know, I believe is what's going on among some mine operators in the country, where it's really just a game. And they can postpone paying the monetary penalties for 3 and 4 years. And, you know, that's a problem. So obviously these penalties are not a deterrent. And do not create the incentive for the mine operators to say, we're going to find and fix our own hazards, and we're going to set our goal for ourselves, but then when the inspector comes, they won't be able to find anything wrong.
And certainly it's just sort of staggering when you look at just this particular mine. In the last 5 years, had more than 1,300 safety violations. In the previous month,
right,
it had something like 57 safety violations.
Right.
So
right.
With that kind of a record, you would think that there's some sort of problem with the sanctions that are available or the sanctions that are exercised.
Right.
If you can pile up in 5 years 1,300 safety violations.
Right. I think the challenge, the Mine Act, I believe, no disrespect to President Obama. I mean, the Mine Act is a very progressive and robust statute. But like any law, when it's not been reviewed, you know, for 40 years, people who want to get around, you know, skirt the rules, they'll find ways to do it. And I think some of that game playing is going on. I think we've heard a lot in the news and people criticizing that the mine was not shut down. And I think when you look at the statute, the agency has authority to do that in several different instances. The real question is the American public and our lawmakers, would they really support the federal government coming in and shutting down a workplace? What I believe, if we were to look at the data on mines in our country, this particular mine is probably the one that had, you know, the terrible catastrophe. I don't believe it's the only one in the country that has a safety record like that. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably 10% of mines in the country that have a safety record like that. So we'd be talking about 40 mines that we'd be shutting down to compel them to change the way they operate. And when I hear the rhetoric here in Washington, D.C. and across the country, the Tea Party people and anti-regulatory and all of that, I think it would be very hard for decision makers at the Mine Safety Agency, at the Department of Labor and the White House to make a policy decision that, yes, if we get, you know, if you have mines that reach this threshold, they're going to be shut down. And it's easy Monday morning quarterbacking to say, in retrospect, now that 29 men are dead, that that mine should have been shut down. But the real challenge as a society is if we look at the safety records of all of the mines across the country and we see that there are dozens of them with problems, are we prepared as a society to say, you know what, those men's lives are more important than the profits of the companies that, you know, operate those mines? And I'm not sure that the American public is ready for that type of aggressive action.
We're at our midpoint here. I have callers. I promise I'll get right to you. I do, however, want to very quickly introduce again the guest for anybody who has just tuned in. Dr. Celeste Monforton is assistant research professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health. That's at the School of Public Health and Health Services at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And her expertise includes environmental and occupational health, injury prevention, and mine worker health and safety. We have several callers. We'll get right to them and start here with someone in Urbana. Anna and line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Hi. I have a comment to make. It would seem to me that due to the type of violations that this mine had on record and the appeals in process, that perhaps this mine... Well, first of all, I have a question. Are the miners themselves aware of the violations and those in appeal? When they go in the mine each day, are they aware of the violations and those in the appeal process?
The miners are aware of when the inspector either writes up an order or a citation. Those are available to the miners. They can be posted on a bulletin board. And I give MSHA, the Mine Safety Agency, a lot of credit. All of that information, including the appeals, that's also all posted on their website. Now, I know not every miner and people in the public have access to the Internet, but it's very transparent. The data is there.
These are some of the poorest people and families in some of the poorest areas that work in these mines. It would seem to me appropriate that when something like this occurs, that the mine owners be fined so largely for each death. We can't put a price on people's lives, but make it so large that they would adhere to these rules and close down the mines until all the violations are satisfied, either through proper addressing or through appeals. I think we just have to make a statement here to protect these poor people. It's just not being done. There's just, for those that were killed, there's another crew ready to go in. Mm-hmm. Because the mine companies are so greedy. I just think that we as Americans have to make a statement here and say, we can't do this anymore like this.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment. I don't know if Professor Monforton, anything else you'd want to add?
No, I think it's right. When you have a down economy and these are some of the best jobs that you might have in those communities, it's a difficult thing for a worker to walk away from a job, even knowing that there may be dangers there in the mine and hazards. Most people don't really think that there's going to be a catastrophe of this sort. But I do think that miners recognize the dangers that are in the job, and the real challenge is for miners to be organized and to take kind of their collective action to compel both the federal agency and the employers to provide safe workplaces.
I'm sure that that families of miners could pursue civil action against the company. Does law, are there any requirements in the laws that have to do with mining safety that says anything about compensation of families if somebody is killed on the job?
So that's part of our state-based workers' compensation system. So every state runs their own system, and it would include both burial benefits to help cover funeral expenses. In some states, the burial expenses is a $3,000 check. In other states, I think Minnesota, it's a $10,000 check. If the mine worker or worker who's killed has dependents, there will be a portion of their previous salary through this workers' compensation system that would be would be paid to the widow and the children as wage replacement. But if you are a worker who, let's say, a 25-year-old that's not married, doesn't have any dependents, maybe lived with your parents, there would not be any additional compensation for the parents. It's just the burial benefits is all that they would get. In the workers' compensation system, kind of the great compromise when that system was set up in the early 1900s was that this workers' compensation system would provide like a no-fault system, and it prohibits workers from suing their employer. And so the system is set up so if you're hurt, you get your medical care paid for. If you're deceased, you know, if you're killed on the job, you'd have your death benefits paid, but you can't sue your employer. When lawsuits occur related to workplace hazards, the lawsuits are typically against not the employer, but against, say, an equipment manufacturer. In the Sago mine, for example, there were examples that the breathing devices that the men used were not working. There were problems with some of the materials that were used to build the seals. And so there's lawsuits against those manufacturers of those products. There are a few states, and West Virginia may be one of them, that if a family can prove, I'm not sure what the legal standard is, but it's, like very serious negligence, you sometimes can convince the court that you kind of opt out of the workers' comp system, and in those instances you can sue your employer. But it's a pretty high burden of proof. For most workers who are killed in our country at construction sites or agricultural sites and refineries, for the most part, a family may try to sue their employer, but it will be kicked out because of the workers' compensation system unless they can identify a product or a manufactured product that contributed to the death.
Okay. On to another call here. Let's go to Champaign, line one. Hello.
I don't know whether in terms of, an area that you'd like to comment on, but today being Earth Day, I'm wondering, what about the safety issues with mountaintop removal? I know that in terms of environmentally that it's not one of the more positive things. So do you have any comment there?
Yeah, I do think about this a lot, and I talk with my students about it. I think we have to step back and say, are fossil fuels sustainable for our global planet? And I think that when we look at the research, we realize that fossil fuel burning is bad for the planet and that we should move away from fossil fuels in exchange for more renewable resources. You can look and compare, the safety of underground mining versus surface mining, and you will have some, comparisons there. You can also look at the environmental impacts of surface versus underground. And, one could look at the data on both sides of that ledger and make the case for one or the other. But for me, from a public health perspective, I think that in some ways is kind of a short-term academic exercise when really we should be looking at the larger picture and say, what are the energy sources that we should be investing in and using so that we can get away from fossil fuels?
All right. I hope to get to the question of the caller. I have several others, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes of the program, so I'm going to go on again to the next, and this is someone in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I've been told that the Massey mine is a non-union mine. Could you confirm whether that's true or not? And in general, do you know of any comparisons between the safety records in union mines as opposed to non-union mines?
Excellent question. This particular Massey mine was a non-union mine, and I think there are some people who've written extensively on the Massey Energies and Mr. Donald Blankenship's kind of history with the Mine Workers Union and some union busting activities. With respect to the epidemiological data on union mines versus non-union mines, I've not done any of that analysis myself. The little bit of data crunching that I've looked at, when you look at the number of violations that are found at union and non-union mines, you actually find that there are more violations found at union mines. I think that what's going on there is if you have an inspector come and you have a very engaged and organized workforce, they will accompany the inspector on their inspection, and they will help be eyes and ears for the inspector and probably find more violations than the inspector would find by themselves. And so it may not necessarily be a phenomenon of actually being, you know, more hazardous because of more violations, but actually that they're finding more and they're fixing more.
How about the Sago mine and this silver mine out in Colorado that you talked about earlier?
The Sago mine was also a non-union mine. The Sunshine mine, I don't know if they had workers represented there. There was a terrible disaster the week before September 11th. The 2 weeks after September 11th, September 23rd, 2001, there was a terrible disaster in Brookwood, Illinois, at an underground coal mine, and I think it was about 13 miners that were killed there, and that was a union mine.
Yep.
So, I mean, for all of these issues regarding safety and health, it really takes a very vigilant and empowered workforce to monitor the safety, to compel the operator to fix problems, and to have that delicate balance of recognizing that these are people's jobs and, for the most part, are good-paying jobs, and you want to keep your job, and how you balance that with the recognition that we need to identify and fix hazards. And so you have different interests there, personal and economic interests, that get into play and can complicate whether safety hazards are corrected.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to next caller on our line 4, someone in Edgar County right here. Hello.
Hello. Clear the air before I start. I used to work in mines as both a worker and a manager. What other industries can you say that are as heavily safety regulated as mining that have better safety records than mining? And also, the shift in enforcement going from collaboration to enforcement in the mid-2000s, that led to a market uptick in problems here in the last few years, even though during the mid-2000s, we were mining lots and lots of things to get lots and lots done and not having that many incidents.
Right. Your caller makes a very important point. There is no other industry in the U.S. in terms of health and safety that is regulated or has more robust regulations than the mining industry. And just for comparison, under the mining law, under the mine safety law, these underground mines must be inspected 4 times a year. If you work in any other industry, if you work in refineries, you work in meatpacking, you work in, you know, manufacturing, there are no mandatory inspections that will be done by OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. In fact, OSHA is not compelled to conduct investigations if there's a fatality. So there is a very, very large presence of the Mine Safety Agency in the mining industry. And workers in all other industries are, there's no comparison when you think about how workers in other industries really don't have the same types of protections and presence of inspectors. With regard to this kind of philosophical shift during the Bush administration away from enforcement to more compliance assistance, that certainly was their philosophical perspective. The statute itself did not change during the Bush years, so the agency was still required to conduct those mandatory inspections. And I think that after the Sago disaster, the light bulb went off that there are mine operators out there that really need to have the big stick. I do think, however, again, putting my public health hat on, that some of what we may be witnessing may be a latency effect, that people, that we didn't have quite as strong of a big stick during the Bush administration. Maybe the mining companies and other employers got a little not as vigilant, and these incidents are rare events. So you really need, you need the five factors to be in line for the disaster to happen. And if you have three of them, you're on the verge of the disaster, but it won't happen until you have all five of them. And it could be that, we're kind of the roosters are coming home to roost now, based on that philosophy from the Bush administration. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware of the 11 or 12 workers that are missing off an oil platform in the Gulf Coast. That's another workplace disaster, and hopefully there'll be some attention on the safety needs of workers in other industries, not just in mining.
Well, it seems to me that every time there is a major disaster like this, there's a call for greater regulation. And in fact, sometimes new rules are written. I think in West Virginia, they've talking about new rules in response to this. After Sago, the House actually passed a new package of tougher regulations for mining. It didn't get through the Senate, and I actually think that President Bush had been on record as saying if it did pass the Congress, he'd veto it.
Right.
So then that comes to the Obama administration, and whether you think that this administration, now the president has said some things about this being a failure of oversight, whether this administration is going to be any tougher, and whether the Congress would be any more willing to pass tougher regulations.
Yeah, I sure hope that that people have had a wake-up call now to realize that our laws need to be strengthened, that there are occupations out there where workers don't have all the protections that they need, and that there are deficiencies in our laws, and we need stronger protection for workers. My hope is that there's a recognition that some of these safety failures are not just in the mining industry, but in other more dangerous occupations as well, and that from Congress's perspective and the White House's perspective, that we seek to protect all workers and not think that this is something just unique to mining, because I don't think that that's a fair assessment.
We have about 5 minutes left. Our guest is Celeste Monfortin. She is assistant research professor in the Department of Environmental Occupational Health at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and mine worker health and safety, one of her particular areas of expertise. And that's what we're talking about, particularly with reference to the mine disaster that happened in West Virginia a little earlier in the month. We have two callers. We'll try to get them in, and we'll go next to Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hello. In reference to your statement, that is the speaker's statement, that in view of the Tea Party people, she's not really sure that the American public would go along with more government intervention, that perhaps it's time the American people realize that Reagan's dictum that government is the problem is insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a very real role for government. And we'd better go back to what had been practiced earlier and allow government to take charge when needed.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. And when I was talking with my students this morning and talking about Earth Day and how that was a very important social movement, I also linked it to worker health and safety, because the worker health and safety laws that we have now in our country, the 1969 Coal Act and the OSHA law, were also passed in 1969 and 1970, and they were really this Also part of this amazing movement that included both civil rights leaders and people from communities who wanted civil rights and a recognition that all workers deserve protection, and a recognition we need to protect our environment, including our work environments. And so we look at that, and that was a powerful period of time where there was public recognition that there was a role for government in protecting communities and the earth and workers. And then, as your caller reminded us, it was this anti-regulatory bent promoted by the Reagan administration, and there are lingering consequences of that. And I don't think we are not back where we need to be in terms of recognizing the very important role of the government in regulating markets and regulating kind of. Not that companies shouldn't make a profit. We know that that is, you know, what they're in business to do. But to have a recognition that those profits should not be at the expense of workers' lives and health.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to one more caller here. Line number one. Hello. This is a caller here in Champaign. Line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm along the same lines as the last caller, as it turns out. In the state of Illinois, our regulatory agency over oil and gas and coal was cut to the quick during the boom era when the economy was great, and so you can imagine what happened to it when the economy tanked. And we all are responsible for this. Human life depends on strong regulatory agencies in this country, and we all need to be willing to pay our taxes so that we can have them. And then we all need to be responsible citizens and study who we're voting for and elect honest people and try and weed out the corruption that's such a problem. Regulations don't do any good if you don't have the manpower to enforce them, and that's the problem with every regulatory agency probably in this country. And we're all responsible for that, and we just need to step up and start doing better.
Excellent
right.
point.
I appreciate the comment. And so you wouldn't want to add anything to that?
No, she makes a very excellent point.
We have a couple minutes left here with our guest, Les Monfortin. Questions are welcome. Someone wants to call real quick. We can get him in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't know if this is too complicated to get into at this point, but what exactly is the responsibilities for regulating of the federal government and the state government, and how do those two things come together?
So on the mine safety side, there's the federal agency, Mine Safety and Health Administration, and that is the agency that is required by law to do inspections four times a year at these underground mining operations. And then there are a number of states, I think Illinois is one of them, along with West Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, that have their own state-based mine safety agency. There will be some overlap in the types of hazards and standards that those state agencies will look at. But I think for the most part, the inspection forces will try to work together. And I know for a fact, based on my experience working on the SAGO investigation, that when appropriate, both the state agency and the federal agency would work together. So, for example, when we were conducting interviews of the survivors at SAGO and some of the other individuals who worked there, we actually would conduct those investigations together. So you didn't have witnesses having to do interviews with multiple agencies. We'd all be in the same room with one court reporter and try to streamline the process. You also have you might have more experts at the federal agency compared to the state on your fires and flames or some of your forensics or vice versa. And, you know, you kind of pool those talents and put together, to get the information you need, but not try to duplicate efforts. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of these major disasters, there is a lot of cooperation between the states and the feds.
Okay. Well, we're very short on time here, and I put out the call for calls, and I actually got a couple. So I guess I would like to try to get at least one. Let's try going for a Rantoul caller, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired compliance investigator. I was an internal appliance investigator, not working with any government agencies. My job was to see to it that when they came visiting, they didn't find anything. And I got started right after the Williams-Tigers Act of 1971 and the EPA Act and USDA, FDA, and that type of thing. Mine safety is obviously, I've followed it, part of my loss prevention profession. We're looking at everybody wants to write more rules, more regulations, and these people don't realize that they're applying uncommon causes, you know, regulations to solve uncommon causes that are really common causes of a statistically stable operating system. Am I making sense? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Not exactly.
And okay. we don't have a lot of time, so maybe you can try to come to a point and that we can deal with.
Well, you get a combination of ingredients. You get management personnel themselves in an organization that have coping skills. You have management that's concerned that their competition is violating the law, and if they were to subscribe perfectly to the law, they'd be at an economic disadvantage. Then you get within an organization, you got competition between departments, department heads. That one department head is guarding his budget very carefully, and so he won't do certain things. I've been in this business for 40 years. I don't have enough time to talk about it. But more laws is not the problem.
Okay, yeah, maybe we've got to come to a point where we're finishing up. Can you make some response?
I just want to agree with the caller that managing any organization or business with personalities and competing interests is not something that's necessarily easy, and I don't want to suggest that it is. But when you're talking about safety rules for well-known hazards like combustible dust and methane, I mean, those are things that are well-known, and we know how to control them, and we should not have coal miners in our country dying from explosions in coal mines in 2010.
I'm sorry that I'm going to have to jump in here and I have one more caller we simply can't take, but we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. And I just have enough time to say thanks to our guest, Celeste Monforton. She is Assistant Research Professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the School of Public Health and Health Services at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And Professor Monforton, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thank you, and I appreciate all the thoughtful comments from your listeners.